Hello, this is Scott Poley with the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. I'm here at the Information Security Summit in Cleveland, and I'm joined by Violet Sullivan. So, Violet, can you kind of give everybody a little bit of a background about yourself and kind of why you're here?
Yes, and this is my second time to talk with you. Last year was so fun. My name is Violet Sullivan, and I lead the cyber services team for an insurance carrier, Crum & Forster, part of the Fairfax group of insurance companies. And I came about cyber a very different way, but I also keep my foot in the academic realm. I'm a cyber and privacy law professor at Baylor Law School's program, their LLM program. So I'm on the insurance side. I was former forensics, and then before that, privacy attorney, cyber privacy attorney. And I still am. I still carry it with me. I still keep up, but I work in the insurance side, helping the people that buy insurance to have a lot of resources. Both preventative mitigation, loss mitigation, and also working through the claims process to make sure they are equipped with the best team that they can possibly be assigned with.
Very cool. Yeah, I remember last time I think we even talked about there's a lot of services and things that come with insurance that people don't realize, right? But curiosity, right, when we talk about the insurance space, from your perspective and since last we've spoken, has there been any like groundbreaking or big changes or things you've seen in this space that kind of makes you think about or people should be thinking about in general when it comes to what you do?
Yes, I think that people hear the word cyber insurance and they immediately think that it's only covers cybersecurity events. And right. I've seen, now that I'm on the insurance side, I've seen that there's a lot more that is covered than meets the eye. Every policy is different and every policy might be restricted in different ways. But overall, the language of the insurance policy that you take out for cyber risk can also include system outages. It can also include things like privacy litigation. So even though you might think, oh, that's data that might not be covered, it is something that is falling under some of the policies. And we're actually seeing the weight shift from everything being ransomware claims and reimbursement for responding to ransomware to now the privacy litigation. And that has a longer tail, longer end time to resolving. So it's really shaking up that cyber insurance response process, because now we're not only looking at cyber tools like scanning and looking at the cyber risk, we're asking more questions about data and we're giving more resources on privacy. Like we do privacy workshops now, just like we do cyber tabletops.
Right.
It's very different style. It's not going to be like your playbook, war games style. It truly is a matter of getting the right people together and saying, marketing, what have you put on our website? Legal says, we need to tell people we're taking that information. We can't just take it and sell it to third parties. So privacy or pixel litigation is the very probably hottest thing right now in cyber risk, because there's not settled law around pre-breach, and this is before there's a breach issue, this litigation of what widgets do you have on your website that is intaking information, and are you selling it to third parties, and are you telling the user that you're doing that? So I would say privacy litigation, system outages, those expansive ways that cyber insurance can help out is new to people.
Well, it's interesting you bring up like kind of do like the tabletop for privacy, but I would assume that there's a lot of people sitting at that table that are not even aware of what data is being tracked or collected by said company or whatever. What do you see from that? Like, do light bulbs go off? Do people start to like get really concerned and surprised in those types of conversations?
Completely. And a lot of times it is like the CEO that has no idea. Yeah. And I usually tell people, if you actually wrote it out, because I think about the lawsuits, they start with a complaint. You write, you harmed me in this way because you did this. And if you write out what these websites are actually doing, and it says, we're tracking your mouse movements to see what, you know, what you hover on. We're tracking the, you know, the time you spend on each different picture. All of these things are tracking and just selling for in the sake of ad technology and marketing.
Right.
It seems really Big Brother. So it doesn't surprise me, even if it's not a settled, there's no rule right now around it, but there's creative ways that people are bringing it to court. And it does seem very Big Brother when it's on the paper. So we see judges not really knowing what to do with this, because there's some states that they're getting sued under old wiretapping statutes, state by state. Or there's a Video Protection Privacy Act, VPPA, that was enacted back in Blockbuster days. Someone was running for public office. They went through his Blockbuster history and showed that he rented some naughty films or some films that were against his political interest. And now they have this statute that says you cannot share the history of the videos you watch. So now they're trying to apply it to videos, surveillance, and tracking technology on websites. Just recently, the Second Circuit actually has vacated a dismissal against the NBA for the stuff that they take in on their site. So their public-facing site.
Right.
We're going down page by page by page. That's how detailed it is. And I think it's also cool to know that now we know what cyber scans look like. They're probably the bane of most people's existence. There's so many different scans, so many false positives. There are actually privacy scans out there. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So the privacy scans go page by page, domain, subdomain, like all the way through.
And you have to provide criteria for them to kind of figure out what to look for?
No, it's outward facing. Okay. So I think the question would be is if there's a portal that's blocked by a password, you're not going to get in there unless it's open. But it's going to any public available page, and it's going to look at the cookies and pixels, session replay, web beacon. Like, it's going to look at everything on these pages. And a good privacy report will like detail out every single page and what widgets are on that page. But the interesting thing is that this didn't really, you talk about like the aha moment mm-hmm. of privacy, all this tracking technology, it's really flown under the radar. Like, I remember in privacy conferences like 10 years ago, I would want to go to the ad marketing privacy things, but I really didn't understand the concept. So I was like, I'll stick with cyber. I'll stick with breaches. But this, I think, is this new idea that you're going to be held accountable for how you use your data, collect and transmit your data before you lose it. I mean, this is just total normal use of data.
Yeah.
And it didn't become a realization to public until there was you familiar with the markup, journalistic group?
Kind of, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Kind of like the Record.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other ones. But yeah, they published an article that really kind of exposed it, specifically the Facebook pixel, because the third party selling to Facebook was on so many sites. They actually created a tool called Blacklight. So there's now scanning vendors that can do way more than this, but there's a free open tool that you can search for, like search markup Blacklight, and you can actually go see your own user experience and look at the page and what's on each page. And there's keyloggers. It's crazy what's on those things. And from the friends that I have on the internal decision maker privacy side say, it's not that hard to get this stuff removed. You just have to know who's hosting the website.
Are they responsive to it too?
You have it internally. So she was in healthcare privacy, and she said she had to get marketing in the room and say, why do you use this? And like, this. Do you need it? Well, it's on there, you know? And so I tell people, I think that this problem can 80% of the way be fixed by putting legal and marketing in the room together. And maybe it's not a cyber specific thing, but usually it comes up because your cyber is usually connected somehow with the web presence and the intake of information and where the data goes.
Yeah. So that was going to be one of my follow on questions on that is, does it matter how the data is utilized for it to be a privacy concern? So like, for instance, like I know like a lot of companies and products that are like SaaS applications and things, you want to know how people are using your products so you know how to make it better or know what people care about the most and things like that. But if you're keeping all that data internal, then is that considered like a privacy concern or not?
So that's a great question. Depends on what state you're in or what country you're in. Because data subjects or human beings have different privacy rights where they reside. So it's not...
Oh, that makes it tough.
Right. And so if I live in California, but I go to Texas and I use a Texas website, that Texas website has to honor my California rules.
Oh, it doesn't even matter where you access it from?
No, no.
That's
so really it's really weird, right? Yeah. And I think even lawyers in law school, you're really focused on like where was something incorporated. You don't often flip it like this where mm-hmm. you're looking at the subject. But privacy is one of those like civil liberties. Like we have privacy. We don't have it very clear in the US federally. But EU, the answer is it does matter even internally. You still have obligations as data owners. You don't have to be data processors. Does that make sense?
Well, does that go along the lines of based on how you protect it, not necessarily how you use
it? It's mostly the cure is just tell people what you're doing.
Well, that's true. Being
right?
Transparent.
Like the cure yeah. is that's why you started to see all the cookie banners.
Because then people can opt out if they want, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Just like what I told you about LinkedIn earlier. You know, tell people what you're doing with the data.
So, but you mentioned something else is also interesting. Like as far as the US-based law, is a lot of the privacy broken down by state, not so much federal? So like how did...
There's zero federal privacy law and there never has been.
Okay.
So
I mean, I guess I kind of see that because...
state by state. And we started, so in 2007 or 8, California was the first state to say, you have to notify, if you have a data breach, and then they define data breach, you have to notify the people whose data it is. If it's this sensitive information, they're listed out, social security number, driver's license, all that stuff. All 50 states have copied some form of that, but mm-hmm. they've all made it different to make it harder. I don't know. And then for U.S. territories, they have different laws. Countries have different laws, again, based on the individual. So that's one type of privacy, right? If they breach your information and it's out there, they lost it. They fumbled.
Right.
Now we're starting to see the CCPA, I think of it like before and after. There's like the like post-boom, you know, when people talk about cyber incidents, like pre-boom and post-boom. The privacy laws that are starting to come into play now are still state by state, but they're talking about the usage of data, like you were just saying, like what rights do these state residents have on the data that they give out? And part of what it's, I guess part of the theme of the new privacy regulations coming out are defining more, how do you communicate? What do you have to communicate to users of their data? So before breach, what do you have to communicate? And a right for deletion, like that's something that people want. And before these laws, they didn't really have a way to go to a company and say, take my data out of your system. Now, California residents can do that. But you're seeing other states, I think there's like 19 states now that have that pre-boom privacy legislation on their roadmap.
Okay.
So we'll probably see 50 before we'll see a federal, but that's just...
Right. That's kind of how it goes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those big changes. So...
Well, I mean, it would probably make it easier on everyone if we had a federal
privacy law. I mean, it would. And it's funny because, you know, we talked about, you know, the EU and like kind of how they govern privacy. Mm-hmm. I know just from working in different industries, how that's a pain when you're a U.S. company and now you have to modify how you do business because of those things, right? So like all the pain points there. But you made me think about this. So I don't know what answer you'll give for these questions, but you know, when ChatGPT and AI stuff was coming up, right? And there was that huge discussion as far as what data do they get to use to train, if it's publicly available, if people are sharing their own personal data. And you know, it wasn't always necessarily easy to opt out. I know that when I used it, I was able to find the form for my specific account to opt out, but I also had a paying account. So I think I had more privileges because of that.
Yeah, you did.
But what's your take and what do you know about all of that?
Well, if you don't know what the product is, you are the product, right?
Well, probably, yeah.
The AI legislation or rules around it is all something that people are just kind of chomping at the bit to figure out, like, are we going to have this? The first thing out of the gate has been the EU AI Act. I think they do it well in their approach because they do a risk-based model, meaning the less risky, right? The more like professional services, accounting, CPAs, health doctors, they're going to have stricter rules because they have more sensitive, there's more risk in the training data, like specifically healthcare. Like if they have an issue with treatment or prescriptions or plans that's affecting human life. So that is qualified as a higher risk and more rules are placed on it. So I think about it like PCI DSS, where you have these different classes of merchants based on how much you do. To me, that's my cyber side. There's a risk associated with the size and the complexity. And that's what I think is the approach, at least in the EU, for basing the rules on the risk. And a lot of this is going to overlap with privacy, but it's interesting because we're starting to see different departments, kind of AI governance. I'm in a group called Women in AI Governance, and it's almost too much for a privacy person to take on because they're focused on the intaking information, and then you have to have someone else thinking about the inputs and outputs of the actual artificial intelligence, and it's probably used in a lot of other different ways than just the LLM structures.
I mean, is there any rights they have when you think about training things for publicly accessible stuff in general?
I mean, we'll see with, there's a big open court case, New York Times versus OpenAI.
Right.
That's the deciding. I don't think we will have everyone's watching that one.
Right.
We're trying to see what is going to be that limit of where we get the data from and what's publicly accessible.
From your experience, I know you're not going to sit there and set the precedents yourself, mm-hmm. but like, what's your opinion or approach to that? Like, how do you look at it based on just what you see in privacy and from what's publicly available? Because like, so to kind of go a little bit of a tangent mm-hmm. to give you time to think, you talked about how companies can track individuals based on what they do and what they share. Well, I know from like a threat intel side of the house, we use a lot of open source information to also learn about potential criminals, other actors, how they interact with people. So we leverage the same data to go after, I would say, bad things, mm-hmm. right? But yeah, from a perspective of if it's freely available.
I think it's going to be a question of consent. So if it is freely available, it may be that certain data, I think in definitions, right? There's got to be a definition for data.
Yeah, you're a lawyer.
And there's got to be definitions for consent. And so the question is kind of like, what data are we going to say is, I mean, it's very amazing that this, going back to the surveillance technology, that someone's finally caring about all of this like ad tracking stuff that people have been making. I mean, there's a huge economy around ad technology, huge. Mm-hmm. What you were saying about user experience even, like, yeah. I think that we're going to start seeing kind of the groups of this can be publicly accessible without consent, and this needs consent from the user to use the training data for inputs. And then outputs, I have no idea. Because outputs, that's a whole copyright law issue.
Well, that's true, especially like that,
like,
was like,
who owns it?
That was like the Writers Guild when they were on strike, right? Right. Like when you can make something write like they write just because mm-hmm. you're using their information.
Right, and there was a, did you play with Midjourney,
the art image creation.
Yeah. Which I feel like ChatGPT now, OpenAI now does it just as...
Yeah, they have, it's called, it begins with a D, the model they
use. Yeah. I know what you're talking about, but I forgot it too. Midjourney, there is a US Copyright Office had an issue with someone who won an art contest. This person won an art contest, but they said, hey, we did start with a Midjourney image, but we used 57 different clicks on Photoshop and made it our own. So there was like this progress that we went to as an artist. We started with this image, and as an artist, we changed it, got the end result, won a contest. And US Copyright Office says, no, if it started in Midjourney, it's not yours. And so the question is going to be like, this is going to be a big question of how
just
are we going to,
in general.
Yeah, and innovation. Like, how are movies going to be made if AI cannot be copyright? You cannot copyright it. Right. I think there's still a question. I'm picking on one specific one. Mm-hmm. So there's still an open question on how, and I'm not a copyright lawyer, an IP lawyer, but that's a big interest to me is like, how do we assign ownership to the outputs?
Well, it's
and how do we do it to not inhibit creativity?
So now you've kind of got me on a tangent where my mm-hmm. head's going is when you think of like the Ice Ice Baby and what was the other song that they're trying to say he ripped off?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Queen.
Yeah, Queen, right.
Yeah, yeah. Under Pressure.
Under Pressure, yeah. Yeah. And so, like, it's similar because, you know, there's, like, many notes, right, in a scale. Yeah. And the patterns you put to them, there's going to be reusable patterns.
Yes.
And so who gets
the credit? And whose voice? Like, what if I put the voice, right? There's been so many artists that they've tried to, and I know the artists are really against them using their voice. But I think that, I don't know where I was going with that. I just know.
Well, I just think it's crazy that you with AI and inspiration and, you know, things like that, like the music industry and other artistic places, kind of are exposed to that already. And they've dealt with it to some degree, but some places they've been able to justify that. Yeah.
Well, I use it for, I mean, how many people use it for brainstorming? That's the number one thing that I'm hearing it evolve into. It's like, oh yeah, it's really crappy. It totally giving you a finished product of a paper.
Yeah, I would never use it one for one.
No, yeah. No. And it's spottable now. It's like almost, I have a friend who says, you know, who predicted a year ago, he's like, we're going to start seeing an aesthetic of this looks like OpenAI, this looks like ChatGPT. Yeah. And then we have, like, even the images, you can now be like, oh, that's it, right? It will probably go through stages.
We're training ourselves to identify
training our brain on, it's so interesting. Because you're right. We are kind of training our brain on, oh, there's a misspelled word in that word art in the image. So it must be AI. Yeah. And same with the paragraph structure. If I see paragraphs that all look the same size, that's ChatGPT.
Yeah. I mean,
or Claude or whatever.
And we talk about inspiration. Like, it's almost like a failsafe for me. If I'm trying to put something together, I use it in the form where I'll say, okay, these are all my ideas.
Yes, and put them together.
And like, can you put them together so they're either concise or are there anything I'm missing that you suggest?
Yeah, yeah. I love that prompt. What am I missing here? And sometimes I'm like, can you give me three more things I'm missing? Because that one sucks.
No, all the time, all the time. And we've talked about, I think last time when we talk about, we name drinks for our live podcast.
Yeah. I don't think they're good at humor. I've decided it's not good at clever stuff. It's not good at humor. It can get me to the next stage.
It's like, at his best stage, like dad jokes.
I think it can't get raunchy enough for good humor. I think it's like, yeah, it's not
the
dad
comedian
jokes.
You can go see on like a bar scene.
Yeah, it's not edgy enough because it's just like the neutral. It kind of goes to the biases people are talking about. It's like, it's almost
plus
too neutral.
There are some guardrails in play, right?
Fine. So, well, I do ask it when I usually tweak the prompt. I'll say, can you make it cheekier? Yeah. Because that usually kind of helps it get a little bit sassier.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and what's more interesting with some of those things is the memory stuff. So coming back to privacy, I've noticed that some of the new functions that I learned how to use ChatGPT is they make it more memory enabled. So what it allows you to do is if you have a long running conversation, like some people start new chats, it's better at referencing the memory from previous things stated. So sometimes, you know, as you chat with it, it forgets about what you're talking about and you have to like reprompt it for some other things. Well, now it has that memory. And sometimes you can tell it to forget from a prompt, but if you don't, that memory is there and it's always going to be using that data moving forward. And there's actually in the settings to actually turn off the memory for that chat. Like, you don't want to use memory for this chat. Like, you just want quick answers or whatever. But a lot of people don't know that either, right?
Like, how do I get out of jail? And then like, it tells you, or like, how, you know, the questions you
may not
want
those
remember.
Things. Yeah.
That's interesting. There was I don't remember if it was Microsoft or a Google. There was something that would take a screenshot every couple seconds. And the question got up and got proposed in privacy. Like, is this surveillance? If it's for backup purposes, but if it's taking, I mean, technically forensics does this anyway, right? For the, in the investigation. But there's like, I think there's probably privacy concerns in there. I just don't know what they are.
No, I was actually doing development stuff, and I use it for coding a lot. And the questions I always get was like, well, how much was this done in ChatGPT? I'm like, I mean, I ask it questions, and it gives me things I may use, but like none of it, really, the way I look at it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's always a concern. So incredibly interesting. Like, I've never thought about privacy the way I do now until this conversation, which I know you live it, so like this is your jam. But I really appreciate you coming to have this conversation with me. Is there anything that you want to leave a lasting impression or promote for any kind of lasting statements here?
I think the same that I probably ended with last year, which is figure out what comes with your insurance and cyber insurance. Ask questions, get yourself at the table so they don't forget about security, cybersecurity, privacy. or any data analytics, there is now privacy resources because we're trying to build out services that match the risk.
Right.
So that's it.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed this one. And we'll catch you for the next one.